Good morning. Welcome to the United States Institute of Peace and this session on economic reconstruction in Iraq, some lessons for planners and practitioners. It's a particular pleasure to welcome this morning Paul Brinkley, who has been a real force behind economic reconstruction in Iraq. John Herbst, who, as all of you know, has really led the charge on building up civilian capacity for dealing with post-conflict situations in the U.S. government. Tom Stahl, who's the Iraq director at USAID and has long experience not only with Iraq but with many other difficult places. And Raymond Gilpin, our own Associate Vice President for Sustainable Economies, who's trying to extend USIP, which has traditionally been strong on politics and security, rule of law, is trying to extend our efforts in the economic direction. I think it's fair to say that there's no monopoly of knowledge and experience in the area of economic reconstruction in the conditions that have prevailed in Iraq for the last few years. These have been extraordinary conditions, and the people who serve there have shown a level of courage and commitment that I think we all admire and are thankful for. It's time, of course, to begin drawing some lessons learned from this experience, and this session and many others that will occur in the future are an attempt to do that. Some of you will remember that USIP has taken a pretty close look at some experiments that were conducted in Afghanistan, in particular the Afghanistan Reconstruction Group, which was an institutional innovation that was undertaken in Afghanistan for a number of years after the war. I think of Paul Brinkley's activity as another kind of experiment in how to do these things well. And we're going to hear from him in a minute about what he thinks he's been able to do, what he thinks the biggest challenges are for the future. Then we'll move on to John, Tom, and Raymond for comments on how they see the situation from their various perspectives. After that, we'll go to Q&A from the audience. We'll have one microphone. I'm getting the signal that there's only one microphone that you'll have to line up at to ask questions. Let me ask people who are just coming in to come to this side of the room. You can even come down the front if you like. And let me ask Paul Brinkley to lead us off. Thanks.
Well, on behalf of the Department of Defense, I want to thank Mr. Serwer, Mr. All of the gathered dignitaries here today. It's a great honor to be here today at the U.S. Institute for Peace. I returned from Baghdad this morning, arrived at Dulles Airport and came straight in. And I want to preface my comments with a note of gratitude to USIP. My first meetings with USIP took place in 2006, shortly after we began our efforts in Iraq. And we were the receivers of a wealth of advice and notable lessons learned, counsel from fine people who, from the very beginning of the efforts in Iraq, had invested their time and their energy in a challenging, challenging environment. And so I've got a few minutes to open, and then a dialogue will follow. I want to kind of overview the landscape that we see today in Iraq and kind of give the sweep of our efforts there. We have a lot of our own lessons learned, a lot of things, if I look back since we began our mission in May of 2006, that you wish you could do over, that you wish you could apply lessons retroactively. And I'll try to highlight some of those things, and hopefully, as Mr. Serwer indicated, going forward, those lessons can be gleaned and inform future decision-making about this very critical area of economic reconstruction. I'll kick off with probably the thing on a lot of people's mind. I mean, I am from the United States Defense Department, and it does come to mind when people hear us talk, why is the Defense Department talking about economic reconstruction? Our mission in Iraq began in May of 2006. Five of us visited Anbar Province. And those of you who are familiar with Iraq are undoubtedly familiar with Anbar Province. Anbar Province in 2006 was the strongest holding of al-Qaeda. And the United States Marine Corps was working in a near miraculous fashion to try to secure and sustain some level of security in Anbar. And we visited the Marines in Anbar at that time. And much of what they were seeing in subsequent meetings with our commands in Iraq was economically motivated violence. And if you think of the landscape in Iraq in 2006, what the Iraqi people had experienced was 3 years of continual escalating violence, continual hardship, which resulted in a near complete breakdown in economic activity. In many of our own strategic decisions that we took with the best of intentions in 2003 and 2004 led to and actually contributed to, as violence increased, a further reduction in economic opportunity in Iraq. And so we were asked by our command and began working within the U.S. government structures to begin to address this problem. How do we counter, how do we marshal the resources, the vast resources that were being applied to Iraq at the time to help restore and create a sense of economic opportunity and to demotivate the violent actors who are undertaking acts of violence in return for money? How do you give them an alternative way to go forward? So our efforts began in May of 2006. And the first thing we looked at, as the Department of Defense at that time, depending on the numbers, was spending in excess of $9 billion a month in Iraq in 2006. And in 2006, Iraq's gross domestic product, the majority generated from oil, nominal GDP was in the neighborhood of $35 to $40 billion a year. Okay? So if you just look at the pure math of the situation, sometimes it's good to step out and just think of a problem as an economic problem, even though it's not. Even though it's got political facets and security facets, sometimes it's good to look at the economics. And if you think about spending in excess of $9 billion a month to secure $40 billion in GDP, you just think about it that way, it causes you to question, is the effectiveness of what you're doing in a pure economic sense sound? Is it rational? And how can you begin to use $9 billion a month as a force for economic stimulus to create an environment that is moving in the direction of all the things that we held dear in the early time in Iraq, and that as a nation, present circumstances notwithstanding, I think we still hold dear: free markets and economic opportunity based on free markets. How do you use that spending to stimulate and steer behavior and to shift from a sense of doing for people and more toward what the U.S. learned after World War II? How do you incentivize an economy to move in a direction that is integrated, that discourages violence? How does that take place? So our first efforts focused on how do we get our own economic activity, whatever we're doing to support our vast mission there and the vast number of resources we have on the ground, how do we acquire goods and services directly from Iraqis, not through multinational companies or not through regional companies, but doing business with Iraqis? And we began working to direct and to stimulate local private sector growth through application of business to them. To date, I'll give you some numbers as I go through each of these areas. The United States Defense Department alone has executed business with over 4,000 private Iraqi companies in the past 2 years, which is a staggering number that I still force myself to go and surf through the data on, because you look at it and you think 4,000 private companies, that belies our image as Westerners of Iraq. Those are images I'm going to try to confront with the rest of my statistics in a moment. But 4,000 private companies in the past 2.5 years, given the difficulties that have existed in Iraq, is a huge testimony to their own natural entrepreneurialism and the existence and desire for entrepreneurial private activity to take place in Iraq as you would see in any other part of the world. Probably the thing that was most controversial that we engaged in, and we continue to engage in with good success, is the reversal of policy regarding industrial operations in Iraq. Iraq, prior to 2003, had a very large statist economy in terms of its heavy industrial operations and factories that, very large factories that made just about everything an economy can consume except for technology. Policies initially wanted to discourage the use of those to help facilitate the rapid growth of a free market. We reversed those policies and instead began restarting those operations and then transitionally privatizing them. And myself and people on my team who'd worked in East Asia extensively saw that model for how you transitionally migrate an economy from a state-run model to a private model viewed a transitional approach to be more rational, especially given the violence that was taking place. We began immediately working to make small investments in idled industrial operations and to bring the workforce back online. And again, I want to emphasize as I go through my remarks the resilience of the Iraqi workforce. We would go into areas that had undergone tremendous violence, where factories had been idled for years, and announce we were reopening operations, make small investments in training or to get equipment running again, and entire workforces would come back to work after 4 years of idleness. That wouldn't happen in too many places in the world, but it was indicative of how much frustration and economic will there was to reengage in normal life in Iraq. To date now, we've restored production or significantly increased production in 66 factories in Iraq, all over the country. We've put thousands and thousands of Iraqi workers back to work. We have worked with the Iraqi government to begin the privatization of those operations. And this year, over $1 billion in investment is taking place in factories in Iraq by private investors that were idled prior to 2006 that have been restarted. Those factories aren't in the places you might think of. They're in difficult places, places that you used to read headlines about. But Cuba in Diyala province, which was a hotbed of al-Qaeda activity as early as the spring of this year, Beji in Salahuddin province, Anbar, Al-Qaim, Kubaisa, and Anbar province. These investments are taking place in those long, difficult areas of Iraq, and that's restoring economic opportunity and normal life to the Iraqi people and the workforce there. A couple of more areas that we've had heavy intensity and focus on and have been some real interagency partnerships that have not been highlighted very much in the past. One is in private banking. Most Americans think, or the perception of Iraq is that its banking system is out of date, which is correct in terms of the state-run banks. That has to do with debt relief and international debt obligations that are still not resolved. But there's a vibrant private banking capability in Iraq. And working in support and in collaboration with the Department of Treasury, we've worked to automate and integrate over 150 private bank branches all over the country in Iraq that now have complete linkage to international financial networks. And MasterCard announced the launch of debit card services in Iraq. And across Iraq now, you're seeing a migration to basic electronic funds management that didn't exist. And those banks now are starting to see, and there's data available on this if you seek it from the Treasury Department, you're starting to see the private banks begin to act as capitalization has risen, as we have driven more and more of our payments off of cash to electronic payment through those private banks. We're seeing their capitalization rise, and they're starting to do the things banks do when their capitalization goes up. And again, present circumstances in the U.S. notwithstanding, having the banking situation in Iraq, having those banks begin to capitalize and make loans and do things in the local communities further stimulates normal life and economic growth. Finally, and in the most exciting development, we have worked with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to bring to Iraq one of our greatest resources we have as a nation, our land-grant universities, which are full of some of the finest, most interesting people I've ever had the opportunity to work with, guys with PhDs in soil science and crop science and international agriculture development. And they're working in the field, embedded with our troops or with the provincial reconstruction teams, and they're working directly with Iraqi farmers. And they're beginning to work and define plans in support of the Ministry of Agriculture in Iraq to get Iraq's natural place as a breadbasket for the region restored to Iraq. Today we have universities from all over the United States that have placed agriculture professors in Iraq, and they're working in the field with Iraqi farmers. And the reception to that among the Iraqi agriculture community is extremely positive. So I'll wrap up my comments about our mission and our effort. We now have 300 people in Iraq working in every province, every provincial capital. We are a tactical economic resource that is provided in support of, again, PRTs, civil affairs organizations within the military, the embassy leadership there in Iraq, and through a process where our organizations within our federal government were not designed to institutionally leverage our economy as an instrument of foreign policy, we have managed to work out, through some trial and error over the past 2.5 years, a state of collaborative effort among the agencies that I mentioned, agencies represented here today, where we are collectively projecting our best effort to help bring economic revitalization to areas of Iraq where that is increasingly critical. 40% of Iraq's population is under the age of 15. A 15-year-old Iraqi for the past 5 years has not had a necessarily positive experience with the United States of America. It is absolutely incredibly critical, in spite of our own difficulties, that we continue to uplift and provide access to opportunities for young Iraqis, lest they begin, as their country emerges from this difficult time they've been through, they associate the U.S. strictly with force and military action and not with the best of what we bring, cultural engagement, economic engagement, and that is absolutely critical going forward. And I know the interagency partners we work with and ourselves are committed to doing that. And the cost of that engagement, as opposed to the pure security element, are far, far less. And the benefits to our children and our children's children are far, far greater to having Iraq and the Iraqi people drawn into a web of cultural, commercial, and economic engagement. Many challenges remain. I'll highlight a couple that I'm sure we'll talk about, including the global financial situation. We were seeing an uptick in foreign direct investment in Iraq. There's a pipeline of foreign direct investment moving into Iraq, new business starts, many we have facilitated, many that are happening organically, construction, hotel construction, office construction, infrastructure development, privately funded, that we've started to see plateau, the interest levels plateau as the global financial crisis begins to take hold and starts to impact people's day-to-day investment decisions. That's an area of concern. And the second, of course, which is beneficial to us as Americans, but if you're Iraq and you have to fund your own reconstruction, creates real challenges, is the sudden precipitous decline in oil prices internationally. And again, their budget is directly impacted by that. Their ability to fund and take over what is an ongoing important reconstruction effort in terms of water, electric, basic services will be increasingly challenged by the decline in oil revenue that result from oil price declines. So that is where we are. It's a great honor, again, to be here today. I'm sure we'll have a lively discussion. And, again, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. John?
I am the bait-and-switch portion of your presentation this morning. When Raymond called me a few weeks ago to ask if I'd appear on this panel, I pointed out that my office, the Office of the Coordinator for Reconstruction and Stabilization, has only played a tiny role in Iraq. And he said, well, that's okay. Talk about what you're doing and how that relates to Iraq. And so that's why I'm here. Point of fact, my office, SCRS, was created 4.5 years ago precisely because it was recognized that the way we were conducting civilian operations in Afghanistan and especially Iraq was less than perfect, and that there were problems of coordination and mobilization which needed to be addressed. Now, Paul has provided a wonderful description of things that have been going on in Iraq over the past several years to address some of those problems and to enhance our efforts with more than a little success. But what our office was created to do was to make sure that in the future, when we find ourselves in a quote-unquote stabilization crisis, we organized the entire civilian side of the U.S. government, as well as the military, to make sure we've got unity of effort employing all elements of American national power to address a exceedingly complex situation. And so that's in effect what my office has been doing. Now, I'm not going to describe our efforts because I don't want to move too far from the field that we're discussing today. But while we have not been engaged much in Iraq, our office is growing increasingly involved in Afghanistan. And I'll describe a little bit for you what we're doing and, in a sense, how that relates to Iraq-like situations. We are in the process of creating a civilian response corps of 600 people who will be ready for deployment in the fall of next year. This will be a force involving 8 different agencies. State Department has the lead, but in fact USAID has more slots in this force than any other agency. But other members include Justice, Treasury, Commerce, DHS, HHS, and USDA. And this is something which may be available for the civilian surge which is being contemplated for Afghanistan. What we've done so far is we have a very strong planning capability in SCRS, or I should say strong by State Department standards, not necessarily strong by world-class standards. And with this, we have deployed people to every American PRT in Afghanistan, and we've helped each PRT write a plan of civilian operations. We have done the same for the sector RC East, so that there's a plan of civilian operations for that entire sector. And our team out at Embassy Kabul has helped the embassy create something called the Integrated Civil Military Action Group, which will begin a rigorous systematic effort to align USG actions across civilian and military fields of operation. This will build upon efforts over the past year that we helped develop in Afghanistan for civilian operations. This structure, the ICMAG, ICMAG, will pull together all USG efforts in Afghanistan to focus on sustaining existing integrating planning and build collaboration on efforts underway, such as Nangarhar Inc., a $3.2 billion regional economic growth plan that elements of the U.S. Army and the State Department developed to boost our efforts in eastern Afghanistan. Our efforts will be tied to USG strategic objectives in Afghanistan and apply an array of programs, organic U.S. capabilities, funding, and influence to achieve an appropriate balance of peace-building, state-building, and economic effects in that country. By applying USG effort on these projects, we will directly address the drivers of conflict in the country. The point is really very simple, that we need to be able, in a complex operation such as Iraq, such as Afghanistan, to bring together all elements of U.S. power, to put it into a comprehensive plan of civilian operations, link that with the military, to provide a path forward. We need to as well have trained civilians with the right skills who are able to operate in all sorts of environments, both benign and hostile, and that operate as a team. That's essentially what our office is doing, and we expect to be able to make a very serious contribution in about 9 months. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Tom.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to see you all. Thanks to the Institute for Peace for hosting this discussion. I look forward to being part of the question and answer period, too. USAID obviously has been involved in Iraq since day one. In fact, we had people on the ground in Basra before the statue was toppled in Baghdad. And so we've been part of the process right through. It's been a huge challenge for us, much bigger than USAID normally does. And so we're still in the process of trying to wrestle with it. And some of the efforts that John Herbst is talking about, setting up a team that is ready to do these kind of things in the future, will be very helpful. But I wanted to talk a little bit about maybe setting the context of what went on in Iraq and therefore what we've learned from it as we move forward. In a certain sense, the purely economic issues that we're dealing with in Iraq are not that unique. the former Soviet Union countries had similar, very state-run, centrally controlled economies, and were trying to move out of that into a more market-oriented system. Even Russia and many other places, and Egypt, other developing countries, have faced a similar sort of economic challenges. Now, of course, what makes it unique is some of the security-related challenges, and you have to put that into the mix, as well as certain cultural and other factors in Iraq. And of course, in the former Soviet Union countries, we knew something about those, or a lot more, I think, than we knew going in through Iraq, okay? And that makes a big difference. And I think, again, that's something that the work that they're doing at State CRS would help us to be more informed before we go into a situation, that we have a better plan for how we're going to move forward. Also, our expectations, I think, in Iraq were very high, okay? And that's something that we're all dealing with in Iraq, and maybe they're higher than they should have been, or could have, you know, considering the problems that we had to face there. So when you look at the context of the situation on the ground, even before we went in there, you had a very centrally controlled economy where the government controlled all inputs as well as setting prices for outputs. The banking system that Paul referred to was very limited and very state-controlled. It was very much a cash economy, a very risk-averse economic culture, and no culture of lending. And so it was very difficult for small businesses to start. A lack of legal, regulatory, sort of a policy, institutional environment for the private sector to operate. Even things like insurance and rule of law. If you had a business problem, the court system was not amenable to the private sector. Obviously, high levels of subsidies on so many things, basic commodities, oil and electricity, and so many things are subsidized. And huge issues with corruption because of this centrally controlled economy, not unusual, as well as the problems of the war situation that they'd had in the last 10 years under Saddam. And then, of course, very little economic investment from the international community in the oil industry or elsewhere. So that was all even before we got there. Then we got there in 2003 and said, okay, everything's got to change. And first of all, we took out all the top leadership in the civil structure of the country with the debathification program. We changed all the systems. We said we want to go from a command-controlled economy to a much more market-oriented economy. We put a huge focus on anti-corruption, important thing, but also got people very nervous. And then a very much more decentralized governance structure where we're trying to put more authority at the provincial and local level. So all that on top of a system that wasn't working very well created a very difficult situation for the growth of a market-oriented economy. And that's all what we had to face as we started. Okay. And now, as we move forward in trying to develop a new economic culture in the country, we have to be cognizant of all that went on, and you have to approach it, I feel, at a real comprehensive level and in a long-term strategy. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't need short-term, quick-impact things, and I think that's been something that Paul and his group have been very good at, identifying specific places where you can make some quick impact, okay, and start to get pieces of the economy working that can work in a shorter period of time, like the state-owned industries, some of the private banking that he mentioned. A lot of this job creation is very important, but it needs to be part of a broader, more comprehensive approach to getting the whole economy turned around and moving forward. And that means a lot of things. Like I mentioned, a legal, regulatory foundation environment that encourages the private sector. A competitive, integrated, and efficient banking system. They've made a good start with getting some private banks going, but you need a whole structure in there over the long term to get that banking system working effectively. a viable and effective microfinance system. That's already started. USAID and others in Iraq, now we've done over $200 million worth of microenterprise. There's a huge demand for credit because the private banking system wasn't working. Okay? And the microfinance we've been doing there is beyond what is traditionally microfinance in most developing countries. In other words, we're lending at higher amounts of money, but it's still not meeting anywhere near the demand, even for microfinance, much less at the sort of medium level. And that area is where the private banks are starting, but there's still a huge unmet demand there. The insurance sector needs to be worked on and to protect business and individuals. Things like a pension system, so much of this, financial markets, which appropriately address risk. Looking at subsidies, how do we reduce those? Again, not immediately, but you need a transition plan. And so that your immediate term things also fit into a longer term strategy. Okay. Then there's just the actual employees within the government structure, at the national, at the provincial, at the local level. They need, because you got rid of a whole number of several layers, they need all kinds of training in basic civil service, how to do basic accounting and bookkeeping, contracting, HR, personnel systems, strategic planning, and so on, sort of across the board, but then also specifically within those parts of the government that deal with the private sector, a whole new training system on how to deal with that. There is a natural entrepreneurship that Paul mentioned that you can build on, but you need to help people understand that because they haven't worked in an open society for so long. Direct support to the private sector is something USAID has been trying to focus on, actually helping business people develop a business plan and understand how you go out and get a loan. Hire staff and do advertising and look at your business structure and your inputs and outputs and develop that because people haven't had to do that in the past. Encouraging foreign investment. Again, you have to look at the regulatory environment within the country to encourage private sector investment from around the world. Oil industry being the most prominent of those. And the new oil sector law, we think, would be a very helpful development in that to encourage encourage investment from around the world, but not just in oil. Agriculture is a huge thing. 25 to 30% of the workforce is involved in agriculture, and that needs to be upgraded and bring in private sector. And then there is some actual infrastructure that needs to be done. But you'll notice actually that most of this is not infrastructure. Often we talk about reconstruction in Iraq and immediately people start thinking about infrastructure. But I think from what you've heard already that infrastructure is perhaps the least important. It is important in a number of places, and a lot of the industries that Paul has been working on needed to upgrade their equipment. But it's really much more about the culture of investment, a culture of openness to private sector that is the really important part of the work. It cannot be done overnight. In Russia and the former Soviet country, it's taken 15 years, and they don't have some of the constraints and issues that we've had in Iraq. In Egypt, it's taken 30 years. Now you're actually seeing some major improvements in a place like Egypt. I think in the last few years, they've been one of the fastest growing economies in the world. But it's taken a good 30 years for them to change their whole economic mindset to a more open system. So we need to be a little patient in Iraq. Not easy on them, maybe. We need to keep pushing, but we also need to understand that it takes time. And I think perhaps one of the things we didn't do well enough was to learn from the experiences of the former Soviet Union. That we jumped in Iraq and considered it unique, and because of certain factors like security and other cultural things, there is obviously some uniqueness to it. But on the other hand, there is a lot of things I think we could have learned better maybe from the experiences in the former Soviet Union countries. Obviously, the situation is still fragile. Unemployment and underemployment continues to be a major issue, and that's why some of the things that Paul was doing is very important. Other things to create job creation and to make sure that the work we are doing doesn't cause huge shocks to the system as we try to reduce subsidies and privatize. There's a transition. You don't have to do it all at once. But that takes some planning, okay? And that's a hard part for, as John mentioned, State Department doesn't have a lot of experience in planning. Maybe the DOD does, but it's a different sort of planning. And that's something that I think we need to do together as a group, marshal the best resources, as Paul was mentioning, the resources of the U.S., not just the U.S. government, but the U.S. private sector. I think that's where the real strength of America is, not in its government bureaucrats, but in its private sector, and the experience we've had in other countries. Finally, the international community. So far, what's been doing in Iraq has been primarily a U.S.-led effort, and primarily not only a U.S.-led, but a U.S.-implemented effort. But this is one place where the international community can bring a lot to it. Certainly, the work that we've been doing in USAID has been very much linked in and integrated with the IMF standby agreement process and the conditionality base there, WTO accession. There is something called the International Compact for Iraq that many of you know about. And if you go through it, it has a lot of good detail on the right path for Iraq. And I do think that the international community is interested in this, and we need to find better ways to engage them and bring their expertise into this process. Thank you very much, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Tom. Raymond.
No, thank you very much. Let me start by thanking the panelists for their excellent contributions. I believe that even as we think about state building and Iraq, the economic reconstruction dimension is one that has not received sufficient attention. And I'm hopeful that events such as this would highlight a lot of the important dimensions of economic reconstruction and the economic element of national power. Earlier this month, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair was speaking in Washington, and he recalled comments by Harold Macmillan, who was British Prime Minister during the 1967 Middle East crisis. The reporter asked him to give his view about the Middle East crisis, and Harold Macmillan replied, "There is no problem in the Middle East." And the perplexed reporter sought clarification, to which Macmillan is said to have responded, "Sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East, so it cannot be a problem." I have a more optimistic view about economic reconstruction in Iraq, because I believe that it's not just important, but it is also very instructive. I was really happy that we've had a lot of reference to learning from other experiences and learning about what not what we consider to be good practice, but what are sound practices for economic reconstruction. And I believe that there's a lot that we could learn from what has gone before in Iraq and all the great work that Brinkley and his group have done, but also from other parts of the world where similar economic reconstruction efforts have been undertaken. My brief presentation will highlight not a lot of the issues that have already been raised, but just talk about a few remaining challenges as I see them, and in true USIP fashion, try to identify lessons for both for both policymakers and practitioners. As I said earlier, I believe that economic reconstruction is a crucial part of state building, and it requires a very robust macroeconomic framework. True, there's been a lot of progress in the Iraqi economy, but the macroeconomic fundamentals remain fragile. And the first challenge I would like to discuss is that of core inflation. Although overall inflation in Iraq has seemed to have plateaued or in single digits for the last few months, core inflation is beginning to tend towards 20%. Core inflation is beginning to tend towards 20%. And that is very worrisome because it could undermine a lot of the gains that have already been made and could give the monetary policy authorities a headache in the coming months as they try to address inflation with monetary policy instruments. And the thing about going about this aggressively is that it could have negative impacts for all the great business development initiatives and private sector and private sector reform efforts that require a financial sector that intermediates and interest rates that are real in positive terms. And so keeping an eye on core inflation is particularly important. The food price issue is one. The second tranche of the public sector wage increases in 2009 is something else to keep an eye on. And I believe that keeping the macroeconomy on an even keel is particularly important. The second challenge, I believe, relates to the non-oil sector. When people think about the Iraqi economy, they think primarily about oil. But there is a non-oil sector that should be cultivated if the economy is going to be diversified and robust in the future. The manufacturing sector continues to be hamstrung by unreliable services like electricity and capacity and technology constraints. Quite recently, there have been a lot of revisions of economic growth predictions for Iraq because of the problems in the non-oil sector. The agricultural sector has also been recently affected by recent droughts, and both John Herbst and Tom Still have talked about broader economic issues in that regard. The third challenge is financial deepening. We've heard a lot of the progress that has been made in the commercial banking sector, but the state-owned banking sector and the central bank also require a lot of attention. The central bank's capacity to exercise judicious oversight and regulatory authority over the banking sector also requires a lot more attention. And in terms of supervision, at the moment, we're looking at the banking financial sector and the non-bank financial sector, both deposit taking like credit unions and non-deposit taking like insurance companies, require significant attention. I will close by just outlining what I think are three lessons for planners and three lessons for practitioners. For planners, I believe that first and foremost, we need to learn a lot from other experiences, and that economic reconstruction requires a program and not a project approach. Quite often, we think about economic reconstruction in tranches. We have the infrastructure going at one pace, we have public sector reform at another pace, we have financial sector reform at another pace, very little integration, and that needs to be addressed in a longer term horizon. The second issue for planners is capacity building. Quite recently, USIP conducted a very thorough analysis of the US Treasury Advisors Program in Iraq and found that the business client model for capacity building works best. And it has been very effective, not just in Iraq, but in other parts of the world. And being able to augment capacity allows a smooth transition in the economic reconstruction horizon, and so that both individuals and institutions in Iraq will find it much easier to take over the reins as the international community stands down. And that dovetails with my third lesson for planners. That is, there needs to be a lot more emphasis on institutions and policies and a lot less emphasis on individuals. I'm very acutely aware of the complex political economy in Iraq, but think about it. If what economic reconstruction is all about is laying a viable foundation for the future, institutions and policies are what matter the most. Individuals may come and go, but having institutions that are able to exercise oversight, that are able to implement policies, that are able to integrate an economic structure that has been fragmented for a long time, that's able to effect the smooth transition from primarily state-owned and state-directed economic activity to private sector-led is very, very crucial. So I think the third point for planners should be, let's have more focus on institutions and less on individuals. Practitioners. I think practitioners should first and foremost know that they're not the only game in town. And coordination is key. The problems of economic reconstruction in Iraq are as huge as they are diverse. And it's very important for practitioners in the field to be able to collaborate effectively and to sequence their interventions in a manner that makes sense for longer-term viability. Secondly, for practitioners, the focus should be on transferring knowledge and skills. Unfortunately, a lot of the work that has been done in terms of monitoring and evaluation seems to suggest that the contractor model makes it very, very easy for people to fly in and fly out and not effectively transfer both skills and technology to the local Iraqis. And I believe that as practitioners, and USAID has significant experience in this regard, transferring knowledge and upgrading skills are key. And third and last for practitioners, I think we, and this is allied to my previous point, is that the focus should be more on milestones and not metrics. Metrics are good because we do need to account for use of donor or taxpayer dollars as we go along. But in Iraq in particular, and as has been mentioned, a lot of economic reconstruction requires time. It also requires flexibility as things like the global financial market, like the market and the global petroleum market change. There needs to be that flexibility within the economic reconstruction construct to respond to these changes appropriately. And therefore, an overbearing focus on metrics limits flexibility because implementers are focused on reaching certain goals and accomplishing certain metrics and not having a broader, longer-term view that plots milestones of progress over the longer term. And I believe that not just in Iraq, but as we look at conflict-affected countries broadly, we could see that in their diversity, the need to be able to incorporate a lot of the lessons from Iraq and also find ways to blend what we've learned from Iraq with what we're learning from other parts of the world. I look forward to the Q&A, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Raymond. I'm going to open the floor to questions in a moment. The microphones are here, but in the meanwhile, I'm going to abuse my privilege by asking a couple of questions. As many of you know, USIP rather prides itself on discussions that focus on them, not us, that is, on Iraq and not on our own bureaucratic problems. But I'm going to violate that general rule by focusing on us for a second and ask the question, what is this experience of the Business Transformation Agency? What does it tell us about us and us in the future and how we organize things in the future? I can perfectly well understand why DOD would get involved in the question of making sure that Defense Department contracts go to Iraqi contractors. And I think that's an objective of enormous virtue. I can remember when I first went into Bosnia, we tried and failed to convince the military side of that operation, that it had to pay attention to local contracting, that it had to really sort through the local contractors, make sure it wasn't financing the spoilers in Bosnia. Now, I think a good deal more attention has been paid to that question of local contracting in Iraq, and I think, Paul, you deserve all the praise in the world for undertaking that. But this is an agency which I think my bio say has spent $4 billion. Mm-hmm.
No. Sorry, that's...
That's wrong. Yeah, well, whatever it's spent. It's spent a lot of money. And it spent some of that money on reviving state-owned industries, which is, as you acknowledge, is a reversal of past practice. I mean, this is not a past practice that depends on administration, by the way. The past practice in the Clinton administration, also in Bosnia and throughout the Balkans, was not to revive state-owned industries. And it's only, to my knowledge, in Iraq that we've actually done that kind of thing. So the question becomes, what are the benefits and costs of reviving state-owned industries? I challenge you on that. And is it a good idea to locate a function like that in the Defense Department, or should it be someplace else in the future, the Defense Department having given us a kind of proof of concept? And if you can comment also, Paul and Tom, on maybe John also, on the general question of interagency relationships, not only in Iraq, but in the way we organize economic reconstruction in the future.
Certainly, and I want to start by getting our numbers absolutely right. The total investment made by our effort to date in revitalizing and restoring employment to former workers in state-owned industries in Iraq to date is $64 million. Okay, it's not $4 billion, so let's make sure we get that right. I oversee an organization here in the we oversee an organization here in the U.S. that within the Pentagon that has a large budget related to the Pentagon's business operations, have nothing to do with Iraq, and that's the confusion. So apologize for that. The question of why DOD, and it goes to even some of the comments you heard here today, because there is a very different point of view that you've heard expressed, a different way of thinking about the problem, that we need to collectively figure out how to harness the different pieces. I don't think the same way some of my colleagues think. And I mean, I'm right, just don't think the same way. And that my background is industry. The Department of Defense is the world's largest industrial organization. It has a massive budget. It has business operations. It runs the equivalent of huge shipping lines, huge logistics operations. It dwarfs Walmart. It has a lot of people in it who come from business, who are business people, okay? And so when DOD was asked to get engaged in Iraq, what it could harness and bring in to address business problems were business people, people who are used to working very tactically at a business level to help get employment back, because our troops were being killed by people who were being paid a couple of $100 to set off IEDs. When our kids are dying, when servicemen and servicewomen, when their lives are being sacrificed by economically motivated violence, theory gets pushed to the background. DOD came into this out of necessity. It's not necessarily a long-term structural thing you want as a nation. I have this discussion inside DOD all the time. This really isn't the mission DOD was designed to do, but the circumstances in Iraq led to where we are, and our ability to harness and bring business expertise to Iraq to deal with business problems, industrial problems, private sector development problems, banking problems. These are things we had the expertise within DOD that honestly doesn't necessarily exist on that scale in the other federal organizations. The other emphasis I would make, and you may have picked up some of this tenor here today, our government is designed to project two predominant instruments of foreign policy, diplomacy and force. Its other organizations, we don't have the ability to take a $12 trillion economy and leverage its influence. The whole world, and you can go into the most depressed areas of Iraq, and my colleagues have been in Afghanistan, would probably to attest to this as well, you can find stone huts in the Middle East with a satellite dish on the roof, right? Where 24/7 people have beamed 300 Nilesat channels where they can look and see the lifestyle in the rest of the world getting better, and their lifestyle isn't.
and much of that projection comes from the West. Yet our institutions are not designed to give those people access to that prosperity. And where we tend to focus is what our government is well designed to do: structure, legal framework, macroeconomic policy, which are extremely important, and you've heard some of that here this morning. But I would also argue, I defy anyone to open the United States Constitution and show me a commercial legal framework, right? You go into a country and you have to create a legal framework. That takes time. This is a discussion I've had with the ambassador and other people there in Iraq, that our efforts are complementary when the tactical meets the strategic. There's nothing better to motivate a government to get its commercial legal framework organized than to have to force them through repetitive negotiations of contract after contract after contract for private sector investment, right? And I have sat through horrendously painful negotiations with Iraqi leaders over whether to let somebody build a hotel, right? Because there's no legal framework, no legal structure. So what that's doing, that's a high-risk transaction, a guy coming in with private money, I want to spend X million dollars or $100 million to build a hotel, and he has to negotiate a contract now with the government because there's no law that he can refer to. So that contract negotiation is good to stimulate the development of the legal framework, because now that individual bureaucrat in the Iraqi government has to wrestle with the terms and conditions. Do I want to give him 20-year lease or 50-year lease? Do I want him to renew? Do I not want him to renew? Why do I want to? Why do I not? Transactions coalesce the mind. They help you focus on why certain legal structures are important, whereas just talking about legal structure by itself without any transactions is an academic exercise. It's a theoretic exercise. You need both. So what we have now in Iraq is we have a DOD effort and 300 business people, mostly private sector folks who've come in, who are complementing the legal framework effort and are complementing AID microfinance, which is extremely important, and AID is doing great work in Iraq on microfinance for smallest businesses, and the collective now is starting to work. Is this a good institutional structure? Probably not, right? But that's for the next administration, and people, wise people, will take these lessons, again, with the wisdom of the U.S. Institute for Peace, and they will wrestle with this. But I think the lesson from this is we tend to all, I'm guilty of this too. I see every problem as tactical. Hey, are we going to do a deal here or not? We don't need a legal framework. Yet you do need a legal framework. That's wrong. You do need that. But these are not conflicting things. And too often we think about them as conflicting things. They're not. They're entirely complementary. And I don't know of a single example of a country, including some that were mentioned. China is a good example. The first investors in China, there was no good legal structure in China. I defy you to find one. The late 80s, early 90s, the first investors in China, they had contract transactions with the government, right? But doing transactions led to the development of legal framework, and it accelerated the process. So to me, lessons learned, a long-winded answer to a question, but lessons learned here have to do with how do we marshal all of this when each particular function has a perfectly legitimate way of looking at the problem. How do we take and integrate those different views and recognize where they are complementary and not in conflict, to me, is one of the biggest challenges, I think, that comes out of trying to draw lessons learned from this.
Thank you, Paul. John, did you want to comment?
Yes. I think perhaps the main reason why DOD has played and is playing such a large role in Iraq on civilian activities because the civilian side of our government was not prepared to do the work. At one time, we had the capability. USAID, during the heyday of Vietnam, had the CORDS program, which was able to do this. But that program was dismantled, and that capability was dispatched. Our office is trying to recreate that capability so that the next time we have an operation like this, we have an alternative between force and diplomacy, which, as Paul said, seems to be the two instruments we've got for dealing with national security problems. We need to have a capability which involves all elements of U.S. government and societal power that's able to provide an instrument which can help a country transform itself, at least sufficiently to permit us to engage and disengage and leave stability where once chaos reigned. We have created a structure to do this. We are creating a civilian corps to be able to perform this function, albeit a very modest one. If the State Department's FY09 budget is passed by the Congress, which would give us $248 $8.6 million to create a larger corps, we could have 4,000 people ready to do this work in a year and a half from the time the budget is passed. We have learned many of the lessons of the problems we've encountered in Iraq and Afghanistan, and those lessons essentially call for us to develop a planning capability across agency lines, a mechanism which enables us to draw on all strengths of the eight interagency to prevent repetitive efforts or efforts which are in fact at war with one another. Thank you.
Tom, did you want to add?
Not too much, because I think I would echo what my colleagues here say, that it isn't an either-or. You need the tactical, you also need the strategic. In Iraq, because of the security situation and the factors that John mentioned, that the USAID and some of the other civilian agencies didn't have that capability that they used to, the military was able to go in to places, both because we didn't have the staff, but also sometimes because of security, they were able to move into places that the civilians weren't. And that's something that, as we move forward with the civilian structure, how do we operate in those insecure environments better when we're civilian agencies? And I'm not sure that we've totally figured that out yet. Certainly, I think you have to have a mixture. You've got to have some short-term, quick-impact things, but it needs to be part of a longer-term plan.
Thank you, Tom.
And a more comprehensive approach. And one last thing, you've got to stay the course, too. And, you know, even with, you know, setbacks and sometimes not seeing a lot of progress, you still got to stay the course. And I'm a little concerned about that in Iraq, I have to admit, that as we talk about pulling the troops out, that's a great thing. We talk about focusing more on Afghanistan, but the situation, the economic situation, is still very fragile in Iraq, and we still have to stay the course there and continue our focus. And that means some budget needs from the U.S. government. The Iraqis have a lot of budget. We need to figure out how to better leverage their money, but it doesn't mean that we don't need to be there. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Please.
Norm Olson, Achievable Solutions. Very impressive presentations. I'd particularly give Paul credit. If you're just getting off of a plane, most of us would be near collapse if you were impressively articulate. And listening to the presentations, there sounds like there's almost cause for optimism. But then I juxtapose this on Sunday. Front page New York Times had an article quoting a report that I haven't read, but said essentially we've taken $100 billion and poured it into the sand. They do give credit to the $100 billion is their figure. They do give credit to a USAID for some local initiatives. They like what Treasury has done in stabilizing the dinar, and they said while state and DOD were late to the game, the PRTs are a pretty good idea. Then to punctuate the point, we had this gentleman from an Iraqi newspaper throwing shoes at our president, indicating, you know, it may not be going quite as well as we'd all like. But my question is really, you know, error was inevitable, but we seem to have persisted in it to an awfully long time. What systems did we have in place for evaluating and monitoring progress from the beginning? Why didn't those systems work better in terms of changing our policy and institutions? And what recommendations would you have for the incoming administration for correcting this situation?
Paul, Don?
I'll comment on the reconstruction. Stuart Bowen is the author of the report, the Special Inspector General of Iraq Reconstruction Report, which has been very, very critical of the reconstruction effort. I won't comment on most of the spending that took place and the reconstruction investment that was made in Iraq. And the steps that were taken in 2003, 2004, 2005. There were successful projects executed. I won't comment on the broader brush he paints with in terms of that, other than I would argue a lesson we learned and that that I've already talked about earlier today is there was a desire to quickly execute reconstruction in Iraq. Its infrastructure had been devastated by both sanctions and war prior to sanctions, and in that desire to move quickly, we did not understand the landscape we were operating within, within terms of the local community and the opportunity that could have been created. The other thing I would offer is if you compare and contrast the reconstruction approach initially in Iraq to what we did after, look at the Marshall Plan. We incentivized the development of the European Union in many ways with the Marshall Plan. We used the spending in the Marshall Plan to help steer or to get Europe to stand up itself and take on its own activity, as opposed to coming in and just building things for people. Let's rebuild the sewers, let's rebuild the power plants, let's redo everything for them. So it was a more, if I would use a word, it was a, I don't know, it's too strong a term, but almost a paternalism in the approach. And in doing that, we didn't create a sense of jointness in the effort with the Iraqi people, which I think is something that isn't the case today, and for the past couple of years has not been the case. And that's all I
have. John? I think that we have the solution to avoiding these problems in the future. And that solution has the following elements. One, you need to have properly resourced civilian agencies, and you need properly resourced initiatives such as the Civilian Stabilization Initiative to create a civilian response corps. Two, you need to have interagency coordination, and we've developed something called the Interagency Management System to provide such coordination. Three, you need to have intelligent and comprehensive planning, which again involves all elements of national power, plus also cultural sensitivity and insight. Put those things together, establish a realistic set of objectives, not too ambitious, and you have the prospect of success.
Raymond?
Yeah, I think to add to John's list would be the importance of addressing a gap at the strategic level. We need to ensure that the national security strategy clearly reflects all elements of national power, and that strategies for economic engagement globally do likewise, because I harken back to the UK approach with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Department for International Development, and Ministry of Defense working together, and that was facilitated by an overarching strategic document. And if I were to give the incoming administration one clue in addition to John's, would be exactly that.
Please.
Bruce Balnick from Nathan Associates. I have one rather big question and one rather small question. The bigger question is about the viability of the non-oil sector activities. When you're trying to revitalize state enterprises, one reason that it hasn't been done more widely is many of them just aren't viable. How do you determine, as with business expertise being put in there, the viability of the enterprises? What types of enterprises turn out to be viable, or are these heavily subsidized and you're just creating jobs to get people away from violence? And more broadly, many countries that have huge oil income, oil wealth, they have great problems developing non-petroleum or non-mineral sectors because of exchange rate issues that affect competitiveness of other sectors, including agriculture and manufacturing. And in Iraq, you've had relatively high inflation, you've had an appreciating nominal exchange rate, and those are signals that perhaps many industrial activities and agricultural activities are not going to be fundamentally viable, which also affects the development of the banking system. So the broad question is the viability of the non-oil economy. The small question is what kind of data is available on the economy. Some numbers were mentioned in the course of the presentations, 40% of the population less than age 15. I don't believe there's been a census for many years. 25 to 30% of the workforce in agriculture, where do these numbers come from? High unemployment and underemployment. I've seen statistics on this, but I have no idea where the numbers come from. So if anyone would like to comment on the availability of data. I've also seen reference to household survey that's been undertaken, but I've been doing a web search looking for it, and I can't find it. If anyone could shed light on that. Thank you.
Paul, viability of the non-oil sector, source of statistics?
I'll use some examples. I mentioned that we've restored production or increased production at 66 industrial operations in the country. There's over 250. We have not gone in and done a broad brush. We do focus on things that we believe have the opportunity to be naturally competitive. I will rattle off some statistics because I think, you know, I can sit here and tell you as a U.S. government person stories, but when you see private investment coming into a country and private sector interests buying a factory we've reopened, I'll use an example. There's a transformer factory. They make electrical transformers. It's about a 20-year-old design of an electrical transformer that's widely used all over the Middle East. It's a Mitsubishi design. The factory is in Bakuba, which is in Diyala province. Diyala province has been an absolute hotbed of violence. As multinational forces secured Baghdad, Al-Qaeda moved north into Diyala province, and Bakuba was their headquarters. The government of Iraq, a factory that was completely idled when I visited in 2006, we restored production. There's 2,000 people working there today. They just attracted $80 million in foreign direct investment to take over and run that factory for 15 years. That's private investment. And that's the model we've attempted to use to identify, and that's for electrical transformers. There's huge demand all over the Middle East for electrical transformers. An example of the Iraqi workforce, it's illustrative. There's a large industrial operation in a neighborhood of Baghdad called Dura. Dura was an area that had great violence during the worst of times, 2006-2007. The factory's called HESCO, Heavy Engineering and Equipment State Company. It even sounds Soviet in its you know. And when you go in there, what you find, you see, it's a huge industrial operation. It used to make pipeline equipment, pressure vessels, things used in the oil industry and other industries. And the equipment, it's typically in that industry, equipment has a capital life of 30 years. Okay, and the equipment there is about 22-25-year-old equipment. It's not new, but I could take you all over New Jersey and Michigan and Texas, and I could show you factories that are running today with 22-25-year-old capital, 30-year capital equipment, right? They haven't replaced it yet because its useful life hasn't depreciated yet. It was shut down. We helped get production running, and I went to visit the factory, and I walked in, and it was everybody very professionally dressed, young people, you know, middle-aged workers, and everything was good, and they had a video. They gave me a PowerPoint briefing. They had their P&L, and everything was, you know, I felt like I could have been anywhere. And then I went in the engineering lab. And the engineering lab was a sea of drafting tables, okay? And they were doing old-fashioned blueprint drafting. So you had all these engineers, they had an engineering staff of 200 people. They understand engineering, well-degreed, educated people, but their skills, they weren't using computer-aided design. Our only investment in that factory was to get them cutting torches and things to get the factory more efficient, and we purchased CAD equipment for them and training to train their engineering staff how to do computer-aided design. So their whole engineering staff now has CAD labs, and as the oil sector takes off, the oil industry would much rather buy heavy equipment near where it is going to be used than have to ship it, bring it into the country. Iraq has a very skilled workforce. Accountants, engineers, it's the most 80% literacy, and check the statistic, this is the statistic I use, the one I was given, 80% literacy rate. It is not a country of, our image is the West of the Arab world tends to think of it as purely oil and nothing else. Iraq was a diversified economy prior to all of its difficulties starting in the mid-80s. It is extremely important that that diversified economy get back on its feet so that it doesn't just become an oil republic, so it isn't just a situation where oil is coming in. So in every case where we've worked to restart a factory, it has been with an eye on what can be immediately plugged into and made competitive. I would also emphasize, we talked about subsidies. We need to practice as we preach. We subsidize many industries in this country. Our farm bill, I invite you to go look at it. We talk about how agriculture in Iraq can't compete. Ask if our agriculture could compete if we removed all subsidies. We advise the Iraqis not to subsidize anything, yet we subsidize many things. There are textile factories we've reopened all over Iraq today that make perfectly good clothing that will not compete with Chinese imports. We have textile factories all over America that cannot compete with Chinese imports. We need to be as stringent with the Iraqis as we are with ourselves in terms of our economic advice, because we tend to be very purist in our advice, right? But they're a sovereign country, and if they choose to place a subsidy so that a clothing factory can stay open and employ people, widows and young women sewing things, that's no less appropriate than a textile factory in South Carolina staying open, because we choose for our own strategic reasons to keep a clothing industry in this country. And that's something I think, again, when you think about how we look at these problems, there's best practices and there's practicalities that I think sometimes get lost.
Tom, do you have anything for us on the statistics?
Yeah, I'm not the expert on that, but certainly the statistics are estimates. You know, they're not real hard data that we might have in another country. But we have a contractor working throughout the country with a lot of local staff that works with local Iraqis to develop some of these statistics. And also the IMF and some of the UN agencies are there with that are gathering statistics, too. It's, like I say, it's an estimate, but I think they're relatively accurate.
Please. Yes, Bob Randolph from Carr Swanson and Randolph. Very, very interesting discussion. I've got at least two comments I'd like to make. First, the question is, what are we actually trying to create? And the problem, which I don't think we're addressing, is that we're trying to impose an economic and political system on countries where there's a substantial popular resistance to that. So immediately, USAID, which is a development agency, and even State, which is a diplomatic agency, I think are not really competent to participate in that endeavor. Perhaps what we need is, I mean, let's call it what it is. We need an occupation force, which is an adjunct to our defense efforts to impose this new system. And I'm impressed that you were able to organize all 300 people and put them in Iraq. I don't think, and you, Tom, you can tell me if this is where you, whether you've got 300 people kind of wandering around in central Iraq unattended to. So maybe this is a job that needs to be done by the Department of Defense. Secondly, I wonder whether in this last discussion, and thank you, Paul, whether or not we have the credibility now to impose what looks like being a failed economic system on the rest of the world. And you mentioned textile industry. You might want to mention the banks and Detroit. And perhaps the economic system that might be best adapted to a country like Iraq, and you've mentioned Egypt, where I've worked a lot over the last year and a half, is one that's semi-autarkic, and you use the model, a very successful model, China, Singapore, Taiwan, and Korea, where there has been a lot of governmental involvement in protection of nascent industries. I'd sort of like to have your comments, all of you, on those two points.
Well, two interesting challenges. Occupation forces in the Department of Defense and the question of the system that we choose to impose.
Well, I would emphasize our mission is to enable Iraq to reach a level of normalcy and normal life so our troops come home. That's our mission. That's why we're engaged. We want to get our troops home. There's still 130,000 young men and women who are enjoying the best weather in Iraq right now, but most of the time are sweating in very difficult circumstances. And so there is no broader motive for the Department of Defense in this effort than to create enough normalcy. And the broader issues you described about macroeconomic policy, personally, I'm from California in the tech sector, and the idea of moving away from a market scares me to death, but I'm not way above my pay grade in terms of the issues you're describing. I can't comment beyond that. And this has all been
collapse of the tech market.
I'll turn the rest of that over to
Raymond,
you.
Raymond, John, do you want to?
I think your description of us imposing a system, I understand why you say it. Some might agree it's somewhat controversial. I just make the point that if we're going to be successful in situations where a country has fallen apart, we need to be relatively modest in our objectives. Objectives which can be achieved and objectives which are self-sustaining once we leave. And I think that wisdom in the future would argue in favor of modesty, not, quote-unquote, imposing a system. As for whether this job needs to be done by the Defense Department, I think that it would be a mistake to leave this in the Defense Department, and I know that most everyone over there doesn't want it. And I would say that we can do it better on the civilian side if we're properly resourced. The resource issue is absolutely critical. And also our national image is greatly enhanced if we do this on the civilian side. I can tell you that the efforts that I'm involved with are very, very popular around the world,
and they enhance our national stature.
Tom or Raymond? Tom?
Yeah, just to mention, you know, obviously a component of this whole thing that we haven't really sort of focused and emphasized is the Iraqis, okay? And I mean, I think we're obviously talking about them, but they need to be a part of this and need to be from the beginning and all the way through. And we can't impose on them a system that they don't want, that they don't buy into, that they don't feel fits their needs, their culture, their, you know, what they feel good about. The USAID staff, by the way, we do have about 4,300. 300 of those are expats, 4,000 are Iraqis. And we feel that they're really the core of our development program there. Iraqis who are trained, who are motivated, who have the resources and the ability to work their own systems. We can give them lots of help and guidance, but they really got to do it themselves. But I do think that the best way to do that is, as John was saying, in an interagency effort led by civilians. Certainly the DOD can help in a lot of different ways and needs to be there, especially when the security is a problem, but you know, going forward, civilian-led effort with learning from other countries, but with the Iraqis, actually, you know, obviously, really in the lead.
Yeah, I'll just echo a phrase that Paul used earlier: the importance of creating a sense of jointness with the Iraqis. To my mind, any imposed solution on a sovereign state is most likely to be counterproductive and ineffective. And I don't think it would I don't think we would like to see an imposition of an economic system in Iraq, because it wouldn't work. What I would rather is to focus on a set of economic principles that allow the Iraqi people and the Iraqi economy to exploit their full potential. And whether it's a system that is directed in certain areas because of the peculiarities of the challenges, or one that is more open, I think should depend on that country and its development aspirations. And if, whether it's the United States or any other international stakeholder going in with a prescribed economic system, I think is most likely to fail and be counterproductive. But I think, as Paul, as the other panelists do, that a system that allows more openness and more choice and more space for the entrepreneurial spirit to develop and contribute to national development is best, in my estimation. And that's what we should hope for in and work towards in Iraq.
Please.
Good morning. Wafa Jasmani.
You need to speak right into the microphone.
I'll try. There we are. Is that better?
Yeah.
One of the issues that I have a problem with, it's as if you've just started. It's as if you've just established the economic system. First of all, I understand that you're trying to reform or restructure, but we're years and years after you've already begun, so I have a problem spacing what it is, and are you talking about restructuring or are you talking about initiating, because there's basically a lapse between what I'm trying to grasp here. Forgive me for my ignorance. I'm not an economist. The second thing is, the economic system follows the stability of the political system per se. And of course, it's only normal that one would say, once that is established and is not in an amoebic sort of form, then the economic stability will normally follow. And that is a basic problem, because up to this moment, the political structure is still undergoing a lot of reform and changes in that respect. A main element is a solid, legal, and credible system, because if you don't have that, then how can you guarantee the FDI and so on and so forth that follows? the main thing I'd like to comment on is what Mr. Raymond, I think his name is, just said, is the fact if you impose an economic system on a country that takes pride on its own economic background, because regardless of the previous regime, one of you gentlemen mentioned that we have a very solid human resource base, and economists are part and parcel of them. I would have liked to see have seen one of them among you today, or at least get some of their comments. Any attempt to impose an economic system on a country that is well known, that has a good source of its own, will definitely, as you said, will counter-react. Thank you.
That was more in the nature of a comment than a question, but you're perfectly well entitled to respond. No responses?
No, I could jump in, especially the first comment about it seems like we've just started. Actually, a lot has been going on. Some of it maybe not as visible as others. Paul mentioned just in the last couple of years how much they've done with some of the industries there and the banking. From the USAID side, a lot of things that you might not realize, in addition to the microfinance I mentioned, but also things like, in terms of developing the Iraqi ownership, we've worked with each of the provincial councils now in the 18 provinces, and they have developed their own 3 to 5 year strategic development plan for each province. Okay, and we facilitated, we helped them, but they did it. It wasn't a matter of hiring a consultant to do it, but they actually developed their own provincial development plans, okay, and are moving forward on that. The microenterprise, it wasn't just a matter of the Americans coming in and giving out money. We actually worked through Iraqi institutions, so there are a number of Iraqi micro-lending institutions now which are doing the work themselves. So things like that on that side. On the sort of regulatory side, a lot of work has been done. The WTO accession process, those of you who know it probably better than I do, require that a number of steps be taken in terms of drafting and enacting new legislation, and they've already passed a couple of the benchmarks for that moving forward. So on that side, it's been done. We've been working with the Ministry of Finance to develop a financial management information system. Okay, that's a huge step to move their whole bookkeeping structure, really, from a paper-based system to a computer-based, linking up all the different ministries and so on, with 262 different places that have to provide input. And that's moving along quite well. It's been a 3-year project, and now we've got a number of We're sort of in the pilot phase where they've already linked up, I forget how many, 50 or so, and they're hoping within, well, they're not just hoping, but they're on track within the next few months to link in 260 different places where they're gathering information and therefore able to much better manage their budget. So there's a lot going on, but it's a long process, and a lot of it takes time. There is a certain amount of political will involved, and people's, particular institutions or things at stake, so it isn't always easy. But actually quite a bit of progress is going on.
Please.
I'm Virginia Manuel with Manuel & Associates. First of all, I want to thank you all for your incredible service in behalf of this country in Iraq. One of Thomas Stahl's comments resounded with me, and that was stay the course. I've done a lot of work in Northern Ireland for 14 years, far less complex and dangerous situation, and yet we are still staying the course in Northern Ireland with the special envoy and efforts there. I'm very concerned about the military withdrawal, realizing we've got to do it sometime, draw down, but I just wondered what you all felt about a huge drawdown in a 3-year period, and how that will leave all of our experts like you and your teams in the region in terms of their safety, how it may halt progress being made from all this expertise that's being shared. Thank you.
Paul?
I'll defer on the comments about the strategy in terms of force deployment, but I will comment on what it's like in Iraq when our forces aren't there, because we do a lot of work in provinces that are called PICT, primary Iraqi control, where we turned over Basra today. We work actively in Basra. Karbala province, Najaf province. These are areas of the country that were violent when we began. Anbar province, where we move freely today, we'll have security with us, but it will be low-profile security. And we move and work freely in those areas of Iraq today. And again, if there's one thing I wish, and it's so hard as Americans, because we have other things to focus on, as we should, but it's so hard to understand the nature of the human interaction that takes place there and the desires of the people of Iraq. I've had the good fortune to be in every province, and we spend all of our time initially embedded with our troops and now directly with them. They aspire. They're no different than people met in China or India or anywhere else. They want access to opportunity. They want their kids to be educated. They want an access to a better life. They're not what our opinion of them thinks they are. I'm not saying this very well, but I think we should take assurance in that, and I have confidence in the wisdom of our leaders in terms of the pace, aside from the political ramifications of the daily back and forth. I have a lot of confidence in the wisdom of our political leaders on both sides of the aisle to take the appropriate steps in terms of our own security posture in Iraq. And I have, again, a lot of confidence in the Iraqi people. Bumps along the road and difficult times along the road in terms of if the situation we're in now continues to develop as it has developed in the past year, is the security situation, as someone mentioned, security being a key element to allow people to begin to engage in normal life, I have long-term optimism for where we're going to end up in Iraq. And again, I have confidence in the leadership of our country that within our own debate and our noisiness sometimes, we will come up with the right decisions about how to posture ourselves for our own long-term strategic interests.
Tom, do you want to comment on this question?
Yeah, similar to what Paul was saying, you know, I mentioned that we've got, you know, well over 4,000 staff working in Iraq, most of them Iraqi, and obviously most of them working outside the wire, without the U.S. military presence. It has helped a lot to have the military support for security, and especially at the PRTs, the Provincial Reconstruction Teams, which enabled us, Americans especially, expats, to really be spread out all around the country. But increasingly, our contractors, our implementing partners, are able to work out there with some security, but at you know, just using local staff or others. And like Paul said, I think we're generally optimistic. It'll be fits and starts. We feel that the military is going to be flexible and continue to support us where needed and when needed. But I think it's also, you know, time for us to sort of move into the next phase where we're relying much more on the Iraqis themselves and on our partners who have Iraqi staff and they're able to operate out there.
I'd like to comment briefly on this, not as a U.S. government official, because USIP people are not U.S. government officials. We do, however, have 4 Americans in Baghdad and 11 or 12 Iraqis. And I've got to tell you that the reconfiguration of U.S. forces, and in particular the reconfiguration of what's popularly known as the Green Zone, is going to cause significant disruption and additional costs. There's no question about that. And I don't think this has been fully taken into account in government planning yet. Frankly, I certainly didn't take it fully into account in USIP planning up to this point. I should note also that USIP will publish in the next 24 to 48 hours an expert group report on the Iraq and the Obama administration, which will point at a number of possible hot moments in the next year or so, moments that could cause significant disruption to the kind of reconstruction and, in our case, reconciliation efforts that are currently ongoing. So I don't think your concern is misplaced. I'm concerned, too. I have the same faith in the wisdom of our leadership that Paul has, but I also feel the need to express to them a real concern about the possibility that we won't be able to complete the withdrawal as hoped for because of disruptions while it's occurring. Please.
Thank you. Morning. I'm Salam Adoub.
Please speak right into the microphone.
Yes, thank you. Salam Adoub, former chief investigator of Iraqi anti-corruption, Ethnic Commission on Public Integrity. I worked chief investigator 3 years, between 2004-2007. My experience, I think when I work, I have experience that big challenge or a big problem in Iraq, that's corruption in Iraqi government. That's a big problem. If we're looking for one side, like how to choose employee in Iraq. I found many, many Iraqi high official without degree from college or first degree. I find many ambassadors in Iraq first degree or general manager first degree or big leader in Iraqi army or in Iraqi police, they have a criminal history. In this situation, in this condition, how to work to improve Iraq? How those people planning or you put the plan to improve Iraq, to rebuilding Iraq? It's actually a big problem here. My question, is there any plan to control corruption or... because I don't think that any reconstruction or development economic in Iraq with a huge corruption in Iraq government. Thank you.
Let me first, before I turn to boundaries, thank you and all those who work on anti-corruption issues in Iraq for the courage that's been shown. Tom, I think that question is probably more for you than for anyone else.
Thank you. Yeah. As I mentioned in my remarks earlier, corruption is a huge problem in Iraq. There's no way around that. It's really, I think, a legacy of the Saddam regime, and it's still there, and it's not going to go away quickly. It's going to take time. One of the things that, from the USAID point of view, that we're trying to do is in all of our training programs, capacity building things that we're doing, there's an anti-corruption theme throughout that. So, for instance, we have a program called National Capacity Development where we're working in 10 key ministries, oil, electricity, water, agriculture, health, and so on. And we're doing basic civil service training on the thing I mentioned earlier on, you know, accounting, budgeting, personnel management, strategic planning, and so on. And there's an anti-corruption theme, you know, sort of in each of those training sessions at the 10 key ministries and also out into the provinces. So things like contracting, you know, we often talk about budget execution in Iraq as an issue. But we forget about it's not just a matter of, you know, giving a contract to your brother-in-law, but using contracting procedures that are up to international standards. And so just those kind of basic things, I think, will help with corruption. There are new laws in Iraq and that the Iraqis themselves have put in place, which are very strict about anti-corruption. And, you know, that's for them to put into place. And then that's the kind of things that you've been working on, I know. And it's just going to take time, and you've got to start at all different levels of the economy and in the governance, and I think that's a big part of governance. Another part of it is making things transparent and open and people accountable to the population. So the more we can do things, I mentioned this provincial development strategies. Those are public. There, you can actually go on the website in Iraq, even here, and see the government of Iraq's own provincial development strategy. So then the people know what their own government has committed to and budgets and so on, and that we feel will also help with corruption. But it's going to be a long-term effort.
Thank you.
Peace.
Andrew Cunningham from the Financial Services Volunteer Corps. A quick comment on human resources, and then if I may, a point on institutions. Anyone who's been around the Middle East has had the pleasure of meeting and interacting with highly cultured, highly educated Iraqi citizens. But I'd just like to put a qualification on that. When I was studying Arabic in Britain in the early 80s, the Iraqi Student Society on campus was one of the biggest on campus. And they were all people who were going to be going back to Iraq. A good friend of mine, an Iraqi, did his PhD at Johns Hopkins in the late 60s. And at that time, he tells me, the Iraqi Student Society in the US had tens of thousands of members. And again, they were people who were going back to Iraq. Now, how many people do we think, how many Iraqi students do you think have been doing masters at Johns Hopkins recently or studying in British universities with the intention of going back? And it's not one generation, it's several generations. It's from the early 80s that we've lost that cadre. And that puts a huge constraint, I think, on reconstruction, on ability of reconstruction. On institutions, and I should declare an interest, my institution is working with the Central Bank of Iraq, with friends from state, trying to build that organization and others. And when I was working in Egypt from 2004 to 2006, working with the Central Bank of Iraq, what I saw was the multiplier effect that you get if you have the central bank trying to restructure a banking system, because the central bank can light a fire under the banking system as a whole. And then if you progress from that thought to, say, National Bank of Egypt is 23% of all banking activity in Egypt, and let's say Bank Misr is another 22% or so, you get into a discussion of, well, do you want to work with the private banks? Yes, of course you do. Do you want those banks to become bigger? Yes, of course you do, and they will become bigger. But the fact is, if you're in Egypt, the 50% of all banking activity is state-run, and you have to engage with that somehow. I personally don't believe in corporatization. I don't think it works. I think you've got to just privatize the damn things. But you have to engage with those people. And so let's take that back to Iraq, where you have Rashid and Rapidane Bank, which account for 90% of banking activity in Iraq. You have to engage with that and deal with those institutions in addition to the private sector institutions. I'll just leave that there as a comment.
Anybody want to comment on this question?
Comment on the banking
sector? The only comment I would make is to reinforce. I mean, many of the people we meet in managerial roles and other roles in business and are Western educated. And obviously your point about the ability to have academic exchange and to encourage students from Iraq, young students from Iraq would welcome. I mean, there would be a flood of desire there to pursue undergraduate or graduate level education in the United States. And obviously, there's very little, relatively small amount of that going on today.
Just to mention also, to support that too, I think that's so important to encourage young Iraqis and other, you know, people around the world, obviously, and not just Iraq. We're talking about Iraq today, but just as an example, USAID has something we call the Participant Training Program, where we bring young people to America to get, you know, either a bachelor or master's or advanced degrees. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, we had 15,000 students on any given year from around the world that were supported by USAID to come and study in the U.S. Now it's 1,000. Our resources have gone down, 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 down. And I think that's something that, as we look at, you know, working on building up the resources of civilian agencies to work in these kind of countries, it isn't just a matter of more Americans, but it's also how do we do a better job of engaging and empowering people from other countries. And I think this is one way that would be very useful.
I confess USIP has given up trying to bring Iraqis to the United States for training. We do it when we have to do it outside Iraq. We do it in Turkey or someplace else. It's just become impossible to get visas.
Thank you, Margaret Hayes. My first point would be a comment and maybe a question. Would it not be better if you were talking about all of the elements of influence instead of all of the elements of power? We talk about the use of power, and that sometimes generates antibodies amongst our friends. Second, and this is a question and goes largely, I think, to Raymond and to Tom. A couple of years ago, a Canadian official was doing an evaluation of the ISAF mission, commented that, you know, these things just, this isn't working. He said, these things need to be planned, joint, combined, international, interagency, from the start and on purpose. And it seems to me that what we really, the big lesson learned is that we have to do the planning and coordinating. But I'm not persuaded that this lesson, as it applies to Iraq and hopefully now to Afghanistan, is being transferred to the whole of government so that it influences our approach to conflict prevention and development in other places where we may have interest. And I'd like your comment on the extent to which USAID and the U.S. government might get back into planning, which is something we did in the 1960s, and then decided not to do anymore. And then with respect to, and this would be a comment, with respect to the education issue, to what extent are we dealing with the local Iraqi education institutions as a venue for getting the message about transparency, legal reform, and so forth? In an awful number of cases where we're doing rule of law, we train the people who have graduated from law school, but we haven't gotten into the law schools to change the nature of the curriculum that they are learning from the very start.
I think part of that was for you, John, on the, and maybe part for Tom.
Regarding talking about all sources of national influence, I would say all sources of national power and influence. Regarding planning, the largest office in my outfit is our planning office. I made a crack before that we're not doing badly, although we're not world-class planners. The important thing is we understand our deficiencies. Equally important, we have friends in the Pentagon who are willing to help us. So, for example, General Caldwell, who runs the Army Staff College out in Lawrence, has offered me to send anyone I want from my staff to his 11-month planning course. And he will not only let us take the course for free, he will backfill my vacancies. So starting this summer, we're going to do that. Also, I described very briefly the Civilian Response Corps that we're building. I believe that the most prominent members of that, the most active, what we call the active members, whose only responsibility is to deploy, every one of them has to have a basic planning capability. So the military, including General Caldwell, has his planning course as part of another course, which is a 3 to 5 week module. Every member of my active component in the Civilian Response Corps is going to take that 3 to 5 week module, so everyone is a basic planner. The point is precisely the one you've made. Planning is a critical element of developing our capacity to deal with stabilization crises. We right now have, I would say, a C-plus planning capability in SCRS. In a year and a half, it'll be a B, and in 5 years, if I have my way, it'll be an A-minus, and then it'll be world-class after that. We get this.
Others?
Well, just to support what John was saying, obviously, I mentioned earlier about planning and the importance of that, that it be interagency, whole of government an approach, which I know is what they're focusing on. And just to make one comment about your issue on education, I do think that's an important thing, and we're actually looking at, as we move forward over the next few years in Iraq, from USAID's point of view, whether we should get more involved in education. It's a matter of, you know, resources and how to prioritize them. Back in 2003-2004, when I was there, I know we had a program that was a university exchange program, and one of them with DePaul University was specifically on the law schools, okay, and building up capacity in several Iraqi universities, rebuilding their law school. A lot of it was just getting books back on the shelves and fixing things, but also some exchange of professors and upgrading upgrading their skills. Now, that program ran out, and, you know, our diminished resources, we couldn't continue it, unfortunately, but I do think that that's an important thing that needs to be considered.
Yeah, just a quick comment on Margaret's issue about not just interacting with the institutions, but interacting in a way that changes the curriculum. A lot of the thinking behind things like which economic system works best, what economic policies are most appropriate, are best when they're homegrown. And interactions that affect the curriculum help create stronger linkages between the scholarly side of things and the policy side of things. And it would make the transition a lot easier where you have more people from Iraqi business schools, finance schools, economics schools coming up with not just homegrown policies, but reactions to international policies and trying to adapt them, because the issue of creativity, the issues of creativity and innovation are key in the economic transformation process.
Let me ask the last two to be quick.
I'll try to be quick. My name is Carl Osgood. I write for Executive Intelligence Review. Paul, you defined your mission fairly narrowly as to enable Iraq to achieve normalcy so that U.S. troops can come back home. But it seems to me that a lot of what you've done, particularly with the state-owned factories, has actual broader policy implications. So I'm wondering, if you were given a new mission to write a policy based on your experiences, what do you think the central parts of that would be?
Rusty, well, let me take two sure. at once. Rusty?
Hi, I'm Rusty Barber. I'm Director of Iraq Programs here at USAP, and it actually is an addendum to that same question. So very briefly, on the question of state-owned enterprises, because I've just having recently returned from Iraq, spoken with a lot of USAID development business advisors, for example, on the PRTs, they would like to see a stronger focus on the medium enterprise level. And this comes in the context of your comment, Tom, about lessons learned from Eastern Europe, where those state-owned enterprises were either allowed to go bankrupt over time or to be privatized. And it's quite a different prospect to try to rehabilitate state-owned enterprises that are in a state of collapse as they have been in Iraq. So I'm just wondering, asking you if you can clarify a little bit the emphasis of effort in the state-owned enterprise sector, how much effort and investment is going to that vice at the medium enterprise level. Thanks.
So for us, a total of 20% of our total resources in Iraq have to do with the state-owned industry effort. It is interesting to me that, and this has been a case since 2006, we have an obsession within our collective effort about the fact that we looked at the policy, which was to shut down every factory in Iraq and put everybody out of work and wait for a free market to emerge to reemploy people who had jobs, right? And then were susceptible to economic motivations for violence 3 years later when the free market didn't spring up. 1,000 flowers didn't bloom. So what we're doing is transitionally privatizing. I've already given you examples today where we have foreign direct investment coming into idled state-owned industries that we have restarted and are privatizing. It is the stated intent of my colleague, the Minister of Industry and Minerals, a former British Airways executive, right? London-educated businessman. He's the Minister of Industry and Minerals and my partner. His name's Fawzi Hariri. It is his stated intent, and he is demonstrating it almost by the week, to privatize the industrial operations that we have restarted. But by restarting them, we reemploy the local population, which helps stabilize the local economy. And I'll give you some examples. Those large state-owned factories didn't exist in a vacuum. One very compelling example, I'll give you two. I'll start with the first one in Basra. Large petrochemical plant used to make high-density and low-density polymers, which are essentially little plastic pellets that make everything from these little bottles to anything made of plastic, okay? That factory was shut down as a result of a desire and overt steps taken to idle the state-owned industries. That factory had 1,800 customers in Iraq, private companies, that used those polymers to make things, right? So those were the mid-sized businesses. And every factory you go to in Iraq, if it's a big state-owned industry, it's surrounded just like a factory anywhere else in the world with mom-and-pop businesses, lunch counters, machine shops, tools and dies, local businesses that all depended upon the big factory, which kept everybody employed. And when those were shut down, the local economy collapsed. We're all worried right now about our automotive industry, right? It employs as an automotive industry. There's most people in the state of Michigan don't work for the automotive companies. But if they go down, a whole lot more people are going to go out of work. And so when we think about the state-owned industries, our model is not to rebuild a command economy. We seem obsessed with that. And I think the sweep of history has already shown that if you give people opportunity and access to education and access to stability, the market takes care of itself. It's happened all over the world. It did it without our help, right? We're transitionally privatizing these state-owned industries. We're not revitalizing the state-owned economy. We're not restoring. Communism is not going to sweep the world from its rebirth in the nation of Iraq. You know, that's not the intent here. The intent is to restore employment, enable a transition which doesn't put our troops at risk, which allows our young men and women to draw down and not be exposed to economically motivated violence. That's the intent of our mission. And the byproduct of it is a orderly transition to a free market economy where foreign investment can take place and people can live normal life. And I have confidence, as I think my colleagues do, that if the Iraqis are given access to that, the market and all of the other things that we worry about will take on, they will happen as they've happened in countries all over the world, Eastern Europe, the Far East, elsewhere. I have faith in that, and I think my colleagues have faith in that, and I think that's what we have optimism we'll see emerge in Iraq in the upcoming years.
I think I'm going to cut us off there, and I think we owe a particular vote of thanks to Paul Brinkley, not just for coming in this morning, but for his great service in Iraq, to John, to Tom, to Raymond.